23. When the raid was over, when you started to withdraw, did you go back by the same route as that which you followed on the approach?
More or less. We started off in, as soon as the raid ended, I mean, for about, let's say we were up there maximum an hour. And then, of course, by what time did I say we got there? Round about dusk, anyway. And there and on, and then we motored back in the darkness to get as many miles between us and the airfield as we could. And we were going, a westerly direction, sort of slightly southwesterly, aiming. Well, we were still. The enemy would have been along the Alamein line. We were heading for Alamein, but not to the where the bulk of the enemy were, which were up in the north. We were keeping sort of a bit south.
Heading southeast.
Southeast, yes. Yeah.
You said southwest.
Did I? Oh, I beg your pardon. Yeah. No, we're heading towards
the southern end of the Alamein line.
No, we were going. We were coming from Fuka.
Yes, going back towards
the southwest.
No, that's east. That's towards Egypt.
Wait a minute, where's the
this
north?
Is the west.
That's that's right. Yeah. Oh, of course, east. What am I doing?
Yeah.
Southeast. Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, of course, that's the western desert, isn't it? And I was coming. Yeah, we were going back to, southeast. I did say southwest, did I?
You did.
Well, put it down to old age, I think. But we kept moving in that direction all night, and then at dawn, just after dawn, because we were expecting a load of Stukas or something to come down on us, but all we saw was one single ME-110. And he came down fairly low and came the length of the column. Didn't shoot at us or anything. Don't think he did any shots. He might have fired a couple, but he obviously was a recce plane. And off he went. So we carried on our... still on the same compass bearing, going back. And then... appeared from the north, a column was coming down towards us. We could see the cloud of dust, and we thought, this is it. They're going to come down and cut us off. And so we altered our direction a bit and went further south, sort of given us more time. They were coming down south. If we were going east, they would have hit us. But the further we could go south, the longer, just better chance we had of getting away.
So you tried to evade an interception?
And, oh, yes, because we knew there were tanks and things there, and we didn't want to stop and play with them. And Matt Abram... Well, the ground was a bit bumpy as well. You couldn't go terribly fast.
25 pounds were towed. Right?
That's right. Yeah, with the quads.
Yes.
And and there was one or two little ruts and things. So
yes.
you couldn't battle on. And probably the same thing was happening to the column coming down to cut us off. You see, and Matt Abraham took over the lead. He had an instinct for that sort of thing, getting out of trouble. And so he took the lead, and everyone else followed him. And of course, then soon they started shelling us, you see. So the shells were dropping all around. And then I saw over to my left, one of the both the guns was hit. And the crew were sort of stranded, the thing was knocked out. And so I drove over there. There was only a crew, I think, of four.
What
might have been five.
Equipment did they have? Did
The boofer. That was towed by a quad. And that was hit anyway, and they, so I turned my car and drove over towards them and told them to jump up on the back, you see. And, I'm not sure it was four or five of them. I think more likely five. But anyway, they all scrambled on the back.
Must have been rather crowded.
It was on the engine deck of the thing. And of course, we were still being shelled. And I was inside, you know, with my head out of the turret. And these poor chaps on the back, I felt sorry for them. But you couldn't get them inside anyway. But I mean, I did as best I could to pick them up, you see. And I got down. I had four gunners on the back, and but as I say, we were bumping along, and we were still being shot at.
And how close did you get to the
enemy? You know. Distance, I should say, 1,200 yards perhaps, or somewhere, but you could see the column and the dust and that. We were more concerned as to keep as far away from them as we could. And that's what we were doing. They were coming towards us and we were going away from us. So we, I think, I don't know if we had an advantage or not, but... they could see us, all right, and they could shoot at us, you see. But they were shooting HE.
Do you know what sort of tanks they were?
No, no. We weren't particularly worried. we knew they were tanks and there was nothing we could do about it.
So you were not anxious to become more closely acquainted?
No, no, no. We had no intention of standing and fighting them because we were out in the open. We had no protection. We could do nothing. The only thing... 25 pounds might have been out to do anything at a push.
Yes.
You know, if by the time they got interaction, that they might had shells dropping all around them and being able to, the only way you could do is
keep moving.
Mm-hmm. And hoping to outrun them. Very, very, very close, and eventually we did outrun them and got back to our own Alamein defences. Because I think the further we were going east and south, we were getting near to our own defences, and the German column was getting closer to it as well, so they were probably in a danger of being shot at from the flank.
They might have run into our artillery
On their flank as they were coming south. Mm. Eventually we got back to our own lines, with the only casualty being the Beaufort's gun that was destroyed.
Did you manage to get the gunners back safely?
Yes, they stayed on my armoured car until we got back into our own sort of Liga area. And they stayed the night in the squadron Liga, and the next morning I put them back onto my armoured car and took them to their commanding officer close by anyway. But and he thanked me for bringing them back, and that was it. Yeah, so, but it was a very exciting trip, really.
Did you ever hear whether you'd done any damage?
No. I think the thing was, those sort of things were only pinpricks in the whole battle thing.
Like career tactics, isn't it?
Mm.
A raid.
That's right, and out. And that, I think it, A, served the purpose of warning Rommel, A, you're not having it all your own way, and he might have thought, oh, there's stuff down the bottom here, let's slow up a bit.
Well, quite often the purpose of that sort of action is to make the enemy deploy away from his front line to his rear areas.
That's right. So that might
disperse on.
That's what might have been the plan then. Just a pinprick, but that makes them think, well, you know, you better take something from there and put there, just in case this happens again.
Who was actually in command of the raid? Was it the Gunner commander, or was it the old Carl?
Now, I don't know. I should more likely think it would be the Gunner, because he had to know and do the shooting. I think we were the protection.
So you were in support?
I should say so. I wouldn't say for certain, but I would have thought that would have been the Gunner's party, and we would be there to support them and give them the protection. I can't see that the squadron leader would have... that might have been a joint operation.
Well, it seems to me that the old cars will either be under command of the Gunners or in support.
Mm.
More likely in support.
That's what I think, because it was a Gunner operation with the guns, and our job was to protect them. So I would say it was the Gunner would have been in command.
Who actually briefed you for the operation? Was that
the squadron leaders, the squadron commanders, and they only just tell you, oh, we're going to do this, and we're going to do that there, and that was it. I mean, it was very short. I mean, the big picture was obviously given to the squadron leader by commanding officer and the gunner. You know, so but we didn't get the big picture from we were told what we were going to do, and we played it from there.
Did you meet the gunners at all, apart from ones you
picked up? No. You saw them, I mean, you saw the guns and you saw that, but you didn't you didn't have the chance, really. Mm. And so that was a little
an adventure.
And but by then, the enemy advance was halted at a defence line from Tel Eliza, west of El Alamein, and from the coast down to the Qatara Depression. So I should say the El Alamein, or just forward of El Alamein. It'd be west, I think, El Eliza.
Yes.
But that was the sort of line, say, El Alamein down to Qatara Depression.
So you've got a solid line of defence with the sea at one end of it and the Qatara Depression.
Yeah, so that was a very short front. And what would it be, about 20 miles?
Something like that. And you were deployed behind the line rather than before it?
Yes, at that for a short time. I've got it as about 35 miles from El Alamein to the Qatara Depression. Well, I suppose it could have been, probably. But the Qatara Depression was a fantastic feature. I think probably about 1,000 square miles of salt marsh, petrified forest, boulders, rocks, almost impossible to. I went down it in a jeep and sort of had a look around and that sort of thing, but no large equipment could get through it, so it was a jolly good and a good left flank defence, so a natural one.
You got the ground around the El Alamein line itself, what was that like?
Oh, that was quite normal desert sort of type thing. And there was one or two wadis up forward of El Alamein, and one in the area of El Alamein too, there were one or two ridges and hills and that sort of things, you know, good features. And down near where we were, not far from there, we were down by the Qatara Depression, and we were near, what's the place, a feature, Hemaimet. That was a sort of a hill that stood out more or less on its own, and that was where we used to do lots of patrols in that area, which was the southern flank of German southern flank as well, you see.
Were you patrolling sort of forward to east west of the?
We were west, watching the west and the north.
Yes.
Sort of that, knowing that our rear was the depression, so we were quite secure there.
What sort of frontage were you patrolling on doing that?
I think the squadron had I think 3 or 4 miles easily. It was a normal thing, a troop with it spread out and then another troop on the side, so easily 3 or 4 miles, might have been more.
But were you deploying in the normal way?
Yes, just still the same. Mm. But by then, you see, we were forward of our main line.
Yes.
We were forward of the main defences. And up near the Ragged Wadi too, which was another feature in front of the Alamein line, the main line.
Presumably the enemy might have been able to use that wadi as a forming up area.
Yes. In fact, they did attack there. Mm-hmm. And that was where Rommel met his Waterloo. You know, which sort of reckoned was the first battle of Alamein, where he lost a lot of tanks. Mm-hmm. And of course the Air Force played a big part mm-hmm. in that.
Did you have any encounters with the enemy while you were doing these patrols?
Oh yes, yes. Only in a small way, you know, nothing big until he started his push.
Yes.
Just about when I think it was Auchinleck who was in command then, just before Montgomery took over. But by then, we were getting all the supplies coming up to Alamein, so sort of good tanks, and we had the support of the Air Force, which was just down the road, you know, so we were on a better wicket.
Did you observe large scale movements by the enemy building up?
No, because they were building up more up in the north. We down on the flank, I think there were probably a few Italian divisions in that area, but we didn't see a great deal, just the odd vehicles and the movement, but nothing big, because I think that was all up the top.
Did you have any meeting with the Italian recce forces?
No, didn't see them. I think it was just when we were down in that area, again, an RAF, a Messerschmitt 109 came over my head and he crashed about 100 yards away. Again, coming in at a dive. And when I walked over to the thing, you couldn't find one bit of the pilot, just probably a few bits of flesh and nothing you couldn't get anything, say, to, oh, let's bury them, poor blood, because there was just bits and pieces. And that was, again, a bit unfortunate for him anyway. But and on the 14th of July, we were in a wadi, and again, it was just slightly forward of the main line. And I've never seen so many flies in my life. It was thick with them. If you made a brew of tea, by the time you poured it into the mug and took the pot away, it was a quarter an inch thick with flies. I've never seen, if you opened a tin of bully, the flies would be there, and they'd be all around your face and on your lips. And the only relief you could get, I mean, you couldn't drink anything unless you got a mosquito net and covered yourself with it and then made something and could drink it then. Otherwise, I've never known a place that was so alive with flies.
You haven't mentioned flies before.
No.
Have you been?
I think so, but not to that extent. We hadn't, you know, you always got the flies and that sort of thing, but not where they were sort of, as I say, you pour a cup of tea out and zoom, and that would be, the whole rim of the mud would be thick with them, and they'd be in the tea, and, you know, and you couldn't touch it. I think there had been probably a few dead bodies been there before, and I think that's what it did it. But we had to stay there. I think we were there for about 24 hours, which was pretty awful. Millions of them. And we hadn't seen anything like that anywhere on the desert before.
What other wildlife? Had you seen anything else?
We saw a gazelle once out on the desert somewhere. And one place, I can't remember where it was, we were down south a bit, sort of, not in this particular area, but when we were up in the desert, further up. I went down, and we suddenly came across a wadi, and it was alive with flowers and little birds. And, you know, it was fantastic to get right out in the wild like that and suddenly come across this little wadi full of pretty flowers and birds, sort of little tit-type things and that.
Presumably it must have had some water.
It must have done, yeah. But it was lovely to see. But I think that's what's so fascinating about the desert. You know, there's such a variety of soil, sand, rocks, life. Life is there. Even you think it's not, nothing could grow there, you would find something like these flowers and things. Yeah, it's beautiful. We stayed in that place with the flies for about 36 hours, which was a bit of a torturous thing. And we kept being switched around in certain places over a period of about a month or so. Just patrolling, and yes, and different points. And then we finished up down on this feature of Hemimet, close to the. We sent one or two patrols using jeeps down to the Katara Depression, just to get.
Did you go in, you know, on your own?
Oh no, we probably had a couple of us, you know, a couple of jeeps, and another troop would go off with a couple of jeeps, you know. I think Maine. I didn't think we expected to find anything, but it was interesting to go down and see what it was like. And again, you needed to, in case one of you broke down or got stuck or anything. You had
how many people would there be in a jeep on a patrol like that?
Three.
Did you have any weapons?
Oh, only our personal weapons and a brain gun. You always had a brain gun in there. You had a radio.
Yes.
You see, and so later on the desert, we set up having a troop of
jeeps.
Well, my impression of that when I got down there, it was. I don't know how much it is below sea level, but no doubt you find that out anyway. It's well below sea level. And very eerie, no sign of life whatsoever. Boulders, pieces of petrified forest wood, and white hills, sand dunes, and scorching sun, because it used to attract the sun. There'd be no breeze really to speak of in a hollow like that. So yes, so that and so nothing could live or grow there. I think it was that sort of, I suppose, rather like being on the moon. I should think. You know, sort of, it's so different to anywhere else we'd been.
How far into the depression did you go when you went on your patrol there?
I suppose we went out in the morning. And we'd get back well before it got dark. So say you did about six, 8 hours motoring around, not fast, but going in. So how many miles would you cover? You might travel 20 miles, 25, 30 miles, which you had to allow for time coming back.
Yes.
So you'd probably do about 40, 50 miles altogether there and return.
But were you looking for anything specific?
No, not really. We were just sort of seeing what it was like, really, not expecting to get anything or to see any enemy or anything. It was just a matter of sort of acquainting yourself with the surrounding area that you were, where you were going to fight. Or you weren't going to fight there, but you want to know what was down there in case you went down. So it was just acquainting yourself with the whole countryside.
What was it going like on the bottom of the Tara Depression?
It was slow, because I say there were rocks, there were boulders, there was ups and downs. So you couldn't go very fast at all. You'd go probably about 15 miles an hour, 20 miles an hour.
Did you get
bogged
at all
down there? No, of course, being in a jeep, that could get through anything. And if you did, you'd get out and give a lift and a push, and you were away. I thought they were excellent vehicles, really, the jeep.
Do you think it would have been possible to put any sort of force through?
No. If a big force got down there, they'd make an ideal bombing target. You know, because they couldn't move fast to get out of the way, and you knew once they were there and they were reported, there'd be some time before they could get out of it.
So it
would, so would be a trap. It was a trap. Mm. Around Hamaima, I said we were. It was very interesting there, because set out, it was near Gabala. There was a tremendous display of strength set out in the desert, covering a vast area. Tanks, guns, infantry, in dugouts, in trenches, hundreds of supply vehicles, all covering this area. And when we drove through them, we realised they were all dummy. It was a dummy brigade down just near Gabala, and as I say, you drove from a distance, that was it, the force. But then when you drove through, you'd see soldiers in trenches, you'd see anti-aircraft guns, you'd see field guns, all made of Hessian and wood, tanks, lorries, and, well, a brigade strength spread over this area.
How close did you get to these dummies before you realised what they were?
Well, we knew it was a dummy brigade, so we were expecting it, but you could get quite close, you know, before you realised what they were. I mean, I should say, 100 yards, a couple of hundred yards, and they looked so good, so realistic. And so it was great to see when we saw them. And they had camouflage nets over the gun positions. And it was really like a brigade laid out.
For the main line, was
that there? Yeah. Or south of, somewhere down. Mine was here somewhere at the end of the Ragged Wadi.
Yes.
And I think the Ragged Wadi was somewhere down here. And it was just, say, in this corner, not far from the Tara Depression.
Yeah.
And of course, then the Stukas used to come down, and you'd see them bombing them, and sort of, you know, because we were in positions to be able to see this. And of course, they were having a heyday coming down and sort of bombing them and disappearing. But it was quite funny, sometime later, when we dropped back, when Rommel attacked in the first Battle of El Alamein, as it was, the RAF went down and machine gunned them. You know, so it was, you know, we were in a position to see, and they must have thought, my, that's the enemy concentration, I'd go down and shoot them up.
So, did they maintain on the secret?
Well, they probably they didn't. They probably they were told probably.